you haven't yet, this would be a great time to check out the Intensive Care Academy over at ICU101.com. That's the sister project to this podcast, where we have video lessons on all kinds of critical care topics, including a whole section on mechanical ventilation and weaning, which would be very useful to anyone who's in the ICU, especially starting out. But we've been digging into a lot of more specialized topics recently as well. ICU101.com, where you can also claim a large bucket of continuing education credit every year. A great deal and a very easy way to go about that. Check it out, guys. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative, storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you again, and with me as always, my better half, some would say, Brandon Odo.
Hello.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about some mechanical ventilation today. You know, we like to talk about the vent from time to time. And we thought we'd talk about something that is, I feel like we say it a lot in the ICU. We discuss it a lot, but I don't know that we really know what we're talking about when we say these words because there are meaning to things. So we thought we would give a little talk about the spontaneous breathing trial. And this is something likely that you guys, if you're in the ICU, are doing on a daily basis, or at least saying you're doing. But let's talk about if we're doing it right and what it is and how we should be doing it. And, you know, Brandon is much smarter than me, especially when it comes to things like ventilators. But we thought we'd get somebody even smarter. And so we're very fortunate to be joined by Dr. Martin Tobin. And if that name sounds familiar, it's probably because you have read Principles and Practice of Mechanical Ventilation, which is sort of the Bible of mechanical ventilation, Dr. Tobin's book. Dr. Tobin is in addition to being a writer, he's a professor of medicine at the Heinz VA Hospital and Loyola University Medical School up in Chicago, where he's been since 1990. Before that, he trained in Dublin, Ireland, and London, and Miami, and Pittsburgh, and he's kind of been all over the place, and we're very fortunate to have him. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, Dr. Tobin, let me just tell you about a sort of a patient who is, you know, not at all uncommon. Let's say there's a 65-year-old male. He has a history of diabetes, coronary artery disease, and he's been having about 1 week of cough with some progression of malaise and generalized weakness and perhaps subjective fevers. Until the day of admission, he had worsening dyspnea and some somnolence. So he came to the hospital. Down in the emergency department, they do a chest x-ray, which is suggestive of a lobar pneumonia. He's also hypotensive and hypoxemic, so he's felt to probably have a community-acquired pneumonia with resulting sepsis. Doesn't seem like a great candidate for non-invasive ventilation with his altered mental status and general complexity. So he's intubated down in the emergency department and comes up to the ICU on vasopressors and antibiotics. He's placed on assist control using a volume control type breath and really never requires a great deal of ventilator support, really just about 40%. FiO2 and 5 centimeters of water of PEEP. A couple of days elapse and his hemodynamics and his mental status improve. So the ICU team thinks he's generally getting better and maybe a candidate to be extubated. So that morning, they perform a spontaneous breathing trial. Let's turn back the clock a little bit because the idea of the spontaneous breathing trial has become like part and parcel of everyday critical care practice, but you know it didn't emerge from the oceans as just the one way to extubate patients. There was something we were doing before, which has now been long enough in the past that many of us have never seen it. But there are other ways to go about it, and this practice did emerge from the literature and in many ways from some of your own work. So tell us about this whole concept and where it came from.
So I mean, obviously, you can arrive at the bedside and you look at the patient, and you don't bother with weaning parameters, and you don't bother with a spontaneous breathing trial, and you just say, I think this man is ready for extubation. Let me pull the tube. Okay, that has been done and that has been reported. And it has a very high risk of morbidity and mortality. So that is not a good approach. And that is the alternative. So what you're doing basically is you're trying to figure out how will this patient do once I pull the tube? And so the purpose of a spontaneous breathing trial is to be able to predict what will happen after I pull the tube. And so you're putting the patient on a trial to guess that. And that's the sole purpose of a trial. It is to forecast extubatability. Will this man tolerate extubation? And in the 70s, I mean, when I began in the 70s, weaning trials were done for 2 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours, 18 hours. So you would have somebody on IMV, intermittent mandatory ventilation, for over 10 hours or something like that. So then, I mean, we did a study published in the New England Journal showing that the difference between a half hour and 2 hours was the same. So it's been kind of decreased down to about a half hour of spontaneous breathing. And so that is what you want.
Now, oftentimes when I teach this, the way I describe it is, you know, a shift from the mindset that you need to per se wean patients and gradually decrease support, and towards the idea that patients are on at a given moment either ready or they're not, their disease is improved and they're sufficiently able to breathe or they're not, and the trial is how we determine that. And the idea of weaning is just not relevant for the majority. There are perhaps exceptions, more chronic patients with a lot of respiratory muscle weakness and what have you. And this is perhaps why some sources now suggest not even using the term weaning and talk about things like liberation. You think it's a fair way to frame it? I don't know how you feel about that nomenclature change as well, but
medicine is loaded with bad terms. There's a whole pile. So if you begin with weaning and say, well, I want to get rid of weaning and I need to use the more fashionable term that somebody calls it liberation or something, you'll spend forever going through all the medical terminology. So weaning has been around since the 60s. So all the literature is on it. I'm an Irishman, so I might say that we will decommission the ventilator, okay? So you can use whatever words you want. So, I mean, I wouldn't get bogged down on the semantics. Get away from the semantics and just say get rid of the ventilator.
Okay, but you agree with the principle that most of the time weaning per se is not needed in the way you might wean a steroid to allow the patient's, you know, intrinsic neuroendocrine axis to come back online, that sort of thing.
You're correct. It is not a gradual reduction. That was the case back in the 60s, that it was a gradual reduction, but the term has still stuck around.
Okay, so on a practical level, I think in the United States, at least, in 2025, the most common strategy being used for this is to place the typical patient on pressure support ventilation, probably with something like 5/5, meaning 5 centimeters of water above a PEEP of about 5. And perhaps people might tweak this in some cases, but as a kind of go-to. Is this a rational kind of go-to standard approach, do you think? I mean, is this how you go about it? Or
first thing to say is that most patients will tolerate weaning and extubation no matter how incompetent are their caregivers. Okay, they will survive no matter how horribly you treat them. They'll get off. But that's not really the goal. So the goal is to try and approach it that maybe the patient might be fragile. And so you're really wanting to give the ultimate care. So I would approach it like, well, this is my sister who's on the ventilator. How am I going to approach mechanical ventilation for her? And if you're going to use pressure support and CPAP of 5, you are placing the patient at a considerable disadvantage. because what you want to do is judge how the patient is doing before you pull the tube. You're trying to predict the conditions after extubation. And so if you have somebody on a pressure support of 5 without PEEP, you are decreasing the work of breathing by 31 to 38% of a decrease in work of breathing. If you have somebody on a pressure support of 10, you're decreasing work of breathing by 46 to 60%. If you have somebody on CPAP of 5, you're decreasing work of breathing by 40%. So if you're doing your SBT using pressure support of 5 and CPAP, this patient is not spontaneously breathing. To call that a spontaneous breathing trial is an oxymoron. It's a self-contradiction. The patient is not breathing independently. The patient is still receiving mechanical ventilation. And so you're misjudging what's going to happen following extubation. If you go from a pressure support of 5 plus CPAP of 5 to full extubation, the patient will encounter an increase in work of breathing at the point of extubation of around maybe as much as 60%. Most patients will tolerate an increase in work of breathing of 60% with no trouble. But a fragile patient may not, and they'll crash. And you'll get lethal hypoxemia.
So you're saying even at what most people would call fairly minimal amounts of support, a pressure support trial on the ventilator on positive pressure with a little bit of PEEP and a little bit of additional support is too easy. It's giving them too much additional support, such that with this notional goal of trialing how they'll breathe with the tube out, we're not simulating that. We're giving them essentially still much more support than that in the typical case.
You're giving him enormous support. It's not a little bit. To say that you're decreasing work of breathing by 40%, no pharmacological agent can decrease work of breathing by 20%. You're decreasing it by 40%. So any caregiver who is doing that is engaged in self-deception. You are lying to yourself.
So the person who does pressure support trials would say, well, okay, if this is too much, then we'll do less. What's the right amount of pressure support to give to neutralize the work of breathing of the tube and try to give the patient a fair, neutral fight?
You don't want to decrease the work of breathing of the tube. That is a misconception again. Because once you pull the tube, the patient is going to have to breathe through inflamed upper airways. They will have been inflamed as a result of the tube having been in place. Okay, and so it turns out that the work of breathing following extubation is about the exact same as the work of breathing through a regular size 8 endotracheal tube. So you don't want tube compensation. You don't want any of these type of things because they're, again, lying to yourself. It's self-deception. So the way to do it is you can put them on a T-piece. You can put the patient on flow-by, or you can set the ventilator at pressure support of 0 and CPAP of 0. It's perfectly fine.
So you're saying for the average patient, if you take the tube out, and I'm sure this must depend on their physiology and the size of the tube and whatnot, but if you take the tube out and they breathe spontaneously through their native airway, most likely the diameter of that airway is going to be similar to the diameter of the tube. So the idea that breathing through this device is necessarily higher resistance than breathing without it is wrong.
Wrong. I mean, there are just very, very, very good studies on this where they have measured using acoustic techniques to measure the size of the diameter of the airway, and then with esophageal pressure to measure work of breathing. This has been done by Strauss and Brichard. So these are very reproducible studies looking at this.
Now, just to, because I think most people are not familiar with this literature, but just to kind of feel it out, it must depend, right? If I have an extremely small endotracheal tube in somebody, if the patient has, after extubation, a great deal of upper airway edema and narrowing, or very little. I mean, these are variables that'll depend on the patient, right?
Correct. But I mean, on average, you know, I mean, if you have somebody, it's unlikely you're going, how many patients do you see with an endotracheal tube of 6? Very few. Okay. So, I mean, you might have an occasional one with 7, but most of them are going to have 8. And so in that case, with an endotracheal tube of 8 or even 7, it's going to pretty much mirror what's going to be the diameter of the airway following extubation.
Now, is there a difference? You mentioned, like, you know, quote unquote, healthy people versus frail people. Is there a difference in patient population? You know, for example, most of the patients that I have in my ICUs on the ventilator are in the neuro ICU or the surgical ICU. So were you talking about people who've had a big organ transplant or, you know, maybe somebody who's had a stroke or a neurosurgical operation? For the most part, everybody in Kentucky kind of has baseline lung disease, but for the most part, they're not, you know, somebody like we're talking about with the you know, pneumonia or we do see ARDS patients, but most of my patients have been intubated a relatively short amount of time for postoperative respiratory failure or something like that. Is there a difference between patients like that versus patients like you would see, for example, in the MICU, where you have people with, you know, viral pneumonia or systemically ill patients like that?
Yeah, I mean, patients are different, but the basic principles are the same. So the basic principles are no different for whether you have somebody with severe COPD and a pneumonia, or you have somebody who's post-CABG. It's still going, you still got to get rid of the ventilator. That's the goal. Yeah. I mean, it is the overriding principle is to realize that ventilators are very dangerous. So each day you stay on the ventilator, you increase the risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia by 1%. And ventilator-associated pneumonia has a mortality of 70%. So a few extra hours on the ventilator can make the difference between death and life. You want to get rid of the ventilator as fast as you can.
So, of course, we could make individual judgment for patients, but, you know, we're talking about default go-to strategies. Your default go-to strategy, for the reasons described, would be either something like a T-piece trial or like a 0/0 trial on the ventilator.
Correct. I mean, typically we will use a T-piece. I mean, and I've been using T-pieces since the 70s.
Now, a lot of people like to use pressure support, and I suppose in this model they would like to say 0/0 because it's, from a workflow perspective, it's easier and seems safer to have the patient connected to the ventilator. It has alarms and whatnot. But from your perspective, that would be serve the same purpose, 0/0.
Correct.
No additional pressure. Now, I have rarely done this, and I've wondered, if you place a patient over 0/0, does that mean the ventilator is maintaining an expiratory pressure of 0, meaning it's not negative, or it's just open to air? It's as if you were breathing normally.
The ventilator companies lie to you. When you put somebody on 0/0, the patient is getting a pressure support of 1. So, I mean, the engineers who build the ventilators, they told me, 20 years ago, Martin, we never put people on 0/0. We always put in a pressure support of 1 for those. But when you set it at 0, but the patient will get 1. But 1 doesn't matter. Okay, there's a huge difference between a pressure support of 1 and a pressure support of 5. Pressure support of 5 is not minimum. An editorial back in 2012 on the myth of minimal ventilator setting. I mean, this is total hogwash. You know, I mean, this is pure rubbish that you talk about minimal ventilator settings. So 5 is huge ventilator settings. And so you, but you, if you put them on pressure support of zero and CPAP of zero, it's going to work perfectly fine.
Okay.
I prefer T-tube because we frequently do research and that's much cleaner. And I don't want a pressure support of one. But for a practical everyday use in the ICU, no problem with using pressure support of zero and CPAP zero.
And am I right that the original work you did with the spontaneous breathing trial and parameters like the rapid shallow breathing index was really derived using a T-piece? It wasn't using anything like 5/5 or even lower amounts of support.
Correct. Because, I mean, because it's very important if you do research that you have clean results. The problem is using pressure support of 5 is contamination.
Now, we've talked kind of more about this, the support side of it, but on the PEEP side of it, some people would say, particularly in certain patients, let's say an obese patient who it is felt probably has a lot of extrinsic pressure on their lungs and perhaps even normally has to fight against atelectasis and perhaps even normally retains some amount of auto PEEP to manage that. And if somebody might put them, instead of 5/5, on even a higher amount of PEEP for a standard trial. Do you subscribe to that, or you would still say, no, I mean, that's too much support for them. I want to see what happens when they're completely off positive pressure.
It is simply scientifically mistaken, okay? There is no such thing as physiological PEEP. I've covered this 20 years ago in papers looking at this. I mean, it's dependent on the recoil between the chest wall and the lung, and there's no such thing. There used to be an idea of physiological PEEP, but this is totally erroneous thinking. And of course, as soon as you pull the tube, that fat patient is going to have to cope with the same chest wall that was present before pulling the tube. So it doesn't, again, even more so in a patient who is obese, who is going to have additional challenges. You want to make sure that you are reproducing what are going to be the conditions once you pull the tube.
So let's say the very obese patient who can't tolerate breathing with a minimal amount of PEEP, or in your case, no PEEP, you would say they're just not ready to extubate.
Correct. Because, I mean, as soon as you pull the tube, how are you going to give them the PEEP?
All right. So that's the approach to this. Let's talk duration. I think most commonly people these days are doing trials probably for a minimum of 30 minutes if you're doing a sort of, quote, formal trial, and maybe a maximum of a couple hours. What's your perspective on duration?
It's very simple. The studies show that there's no advantage in going beyond 30 minutes. I wouldn't have any clue why somebody would want to do it for an hour. It makes no sense. Obviously, these are people who are not capable of reading papers.
Now, is there a downside to a longer trial?
Yes. I don't know what you're doing. So, I mean, I pointed out at the beginning, you can do the most horrible things to patients. They'll still get by. But that's not necessary to do that. You're placing patients at risk. So if you have somebody on a T-piece or pressure support zero, after half an hour, you need to make a decision. You either pull the tube at that point, or you say the patient is not ready and we stick him back on the ventilator and come back tomorrow and look at it.
I mean, one of the concerns people often express is that a longer trial may be fatiguing and therefore, you know, increase the chance of failure, perhaps in a patient who otherwise might have extubated successfully. And I've often sort of wondered philosophically about this, because if your trial truly simulated breathing without a tube, then it shouldn't be any more fatiguing than breathing after extubation. I mean, do you think that if this model is correct, a spontaneous breathing trial is any more fatiguing than breathing on your own?
I mean, we've made the measurements of fatigue using twitch stimulation of the phrenic nerve. It doesn't occur in the ICU. I've induced diaphragmatic fatigue in myself by breathing through a pinhole, where I'll continue to breathe through a pinhole for 40 minutes or something. I mean, I've plenty of experience of diaphragmatic fatigue in myself. But this is not a, 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 a concept that applies to patients in the ICU. It's just wrong.
So leaving a patient on a breathing trial for 5 hours is wrong just because it's irrational from the perspective of this diagnostic
test. Well, it's also inhumane.
Sure.
It's torture. This is, you would not do that to your sister.
So you place a patient on this trial, you give them 30 minutes, and then what criteria are you using to determine if they have passed? Or is it specific formal criteria, or is it more of a gestalt?
No, it's not a gestalt. What you have to do is you have to assess work of breathing during the trial. And the way you assess work of breathing is to insert an esophageal balloon. That gives you a measurement of work of breathing. But that's complex, difficult, and most people are not capable of inserting an esophageal balloon. And even if you're able to insert it, the biggest problem is doing the calculations that you get with the esophageal balloon. They're quite complex. I mean, we've inserted them in hundreds of patients, but this is not for, we only use it for research, not for clinical practice. So what you need to do is instead you use meticulous physical examination. The most important physical sign that you do is to check for contraction of the sternomastoid muscle. And so you check for contraction of the sternomastoid with your index finger and you touch the sternomastoid very gently. You're placing your index finger as if it was an EMG electrode to try and pick up contraction of the sternomastoid under your finger. And you're looking for phasic contraction of the sternomastoid, not tonic contraction. And you're looking to see that. Then secondly, you're going to place your finger on the thyroid cartilage to check for tracheal tug, to see is the trachea moving up and down with each breath. And then thirdly, you're going to look for recession of the intercostal spaces, the suprasternal fossa, and the supraclavicular spaces. So these are all the manifestations of work of breathing. And based on that, you make a qualitative judgment as to whether the degree of work of breathing in that patient. And then you try to forecast what will be the work of breathing once I pull the tube. So it's going to be based on your physical examination. Gas exchange is much less challenging. It's easy to look at the gas exchange in terms of the pulse ox. Occasional patients, you'll be worried about the PCO2 going up. If you're worried about the PCO2 going up, you get an arterial blood gas. But most of the time, you won't necessarily need to get an arterial blood gas. Okay, so then it's based on that you decide, can I pull the tube?
Now, what you didn't mention was the rapid shallow breathing index, which I think for many people, if they had to choose one marker of readiness, that might be it. And some of these people maybe never even saw the patient during their breathing trial. How do you feel about that?
That is idiotic. Okay. That makes absolutely zero sense. The only purpose of measuring frequency to tidal volume ratio is to force you into doing a spontaneous breathing trial earlier than you would otherwise want to do. F over VT has no role whatsoever once the trial gets underway. That was never part of F over VT. Frequency to tidal, it is only important in telling you this patient is likely to do fine on an SPT, even though I think he's not ready. That is the purpose of F over VT.
So to you, this should really be used only as a screening tool for readiness of performing a trial, not as part of the trial.
Anybody who tells you it is useful during the trial haven't a clue what they're talking about.
So how would you apply
There's no testing, no research that tells you it's useful, and it couldn't be useful. It is purely a screening test. That is the only purpose. So, I mean, you want to measure, if you arrive at the bedside and you say, I think this patient is likely to come off if we put him on an SPT, well, you're already getting there too late. That makes no sense. What you want to be doing is arriving at the bedside and saying, I think it's likely that this patient will fail the SPT. So, and that's when you obtain your weaning predictors as a screening test to alert you into the possibility that this patient just might get off, even though you're strongly believing that the patient will not get off.
So to use,
the ideal thing is that the pretest probability would be less than 30%. So you do it ideally when you think it's a 70% likelihood that the patient will fail. That's where you, for any screening test, that's where you get the best bang for your buck.
So to use the rapid shallow breathing index in this way, in a unit where the respiratory therapists are managing these protocols, they would come see the patient. They would place a patient who was on a fully supported mode, like volume control. They would, they would probably put them on pressure support. Perhaps you would just put them on 0/0 or a T-piece or something, measure the rapid shallow breathing index, and then use that to determine, oh, this patient might be a candidate for a formal trial. And if not, I guess put them back on their previous mode. But it, I mean, because of course you couldn't perform this when they were on a fully supported mode with a rate and so on.
Of course you can perform it when they're on a full level of mechanical ventilation. All you have to do is stop the ventilator for 1 minute. It's not really, it's, you have to get your recordings over a minute, but you have to realize when you stop the ventilator for a minute, and you can easily stop the ventilator if somebody is on assist control. There's no trouble in stopping the ventilator. But you'll realize that for the first minute, the data you're getting out are going to be bad data. In physiology, you must have a steady state. And so you need to make sure that the patient is in a steady state. If you have somebody on assist control, you're going to have stimulation of the Golgi apparatus and the mechanoreceptors. So as soon as you take the patient off the ventilator for the first minute, they're likely to incur an apnea in that first minute. And that apnea is commonly attributed to respiratory center depression. And it's felt to be that it's probably related to the sedative agents that the patient is still getting. That's, again, a misconception. The reason you're seeing the apnea is because of the Golgi tendon stimulation. That's what's giving you the apnea. All you have to do is wait for the first 40 to 60 seconds until you can see a proper rhythm in the breathing. And then after you see a proper rhythm in the breathing, then you get another 1 minute of data. And you measure the rate and the tidal volume, and then you calculate the frequency to tidal volume ratio from that.
One of the most common phenomena that might occur when a patient, quote, fails a breathing trial is that they're just very agitated. They're restless, look uncomfortable. They're breathing quickly. They may be breathing large volumes, but they're breathing a lot. And it makes it really difficult to manage these patients because in some cases you sort of suspect they're ready to extubate. And this is purely a matter of you just held their sedation, they're in pain, maybe they're delirious or what have you. But it's hard to assess the work of breathing because of that background. What's your approach to these patients?
I mean, in that situation, you're looking to see how much of the agitation is the primary problem and how much of the agitation is related to respiratory distress. So you're going to have to make that decision. And then how much of the agitation is a kind of an ICU psychosis? So because if, you know, if somebody's stuck in the ICU, day or so is vulnerable to all kinds of cognitive abnormalities. But frequently the cognitive problems are going to be related to the medications. So the temptation there is to give more sedative agents. And then you end up chasing your tail. you're going to have to try and eliminate the sedation as best you're able and to proceed from there. If the patient is thrashing around, well, you can't pull the tube in that situation. Because again, it's not that it's going to be a challenge to measure work of breathing in the manner I told you by palpating the sternomastoids and all of that. It's when you see that agitated situation, you can't safely remove the endotracheal tube. So that has to settle down. You have to try and get it settled down. A big part in trying to settle it down is by talking to the patient. So, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to actually engage in hypnotism, but it's kind of close to hypnotism. It's very important to talk to patients and try and work on, with the patient to get them to settle down and try and talk to them through their breathing. So, it's basically you trying to act as a hypnotist, straight out of Las Vegas.
What do you think about trialing a patient while maintaining some degree of sedation, whether that's a drug like dexmedetomidine, which we could continue after extubation and usually spares a respiratory drive, an opioid infusion if there's a degree of pain, even something like propofol that we would probably be planning to stop with extubation. The idea being that a patient who breathes comfortably and strongly despite those things probably will breathe after extubation. A patient who, let's say, hypoventilates while they're on propofol, that was probably not a useful trial. But, you know, in that one situation where you can manage the agitation and maybe get better data, do you think there's utility to that?
Again, I will repeat my mantra. Patients will do fine no matter how horrible are their caregivers. You can do virtually anything to patients and they'll still get by. That's not the way, that's not what it's about, that, you know. It is to take care of vulnerable patients. Your respiratory centers are extraordinarily important. You don't want anybody tampering with your medulla oblongata. You are highly dependent on what goes on in your medulla oblongata. You want the phrenic nerve motor neuron pool as uncontaminated as possible. And all of those poisons that you give a patient are interfering with the respiratory control system. So you want to avoid all of those medications as much as you possibly can. You may have to, life is imperfect. You will, whatever you do, the goal is to get rid of the ventilator. So the ventilator is much more the enemy than the medications. If the medications help you to get rid of the ventilator, fine. But you're playing with fire. If you have somebody where you think that the patient is fragile in terms of the respiratory control system, because if you have somebody who's facing challenges, you need the medulla oblongata to back you up. You need it there to be on your side. And for you to come in and start hindering the medulla oblongata, that's not a good strategy.
Most people, as part of their routine care, are probably doing breathing trials in the morning and then saying the patient is either passing or going to extubate them or not. And then if not, many times leave them on the ventilator until tomorrow. Most people in general are not doing more than one or certainly more than two trials in one day. What do you think? And I'm going to guess what you would say, which is that it's not fatiguing to do multiple trials, you know, several hours apart, let's say. But unless you think that something has changed in the patient's readiness and work of breathing in between, there's no reason to do so.
Correct. I mean, again, in myself, when we induce fatigue in healthy people, Francologhi, we did these studies with phrenic nerve stimulation. If you do induce fatigue, it takes 24 hours to recover. So that is the basis for doing trials every 24 hours. There's no point in doing a trial 12 hours after the first trial. That's not going to do anything practical. So if the patient fails today, you come back tomorrow. I don't do something in between.
Now, what if there is something that really does seem like it was correctable? Like they just didn't wake up. Oh, we thought it was a sedation issue. Now they're awake and they look much better. Something like that.
Yep, that's fine. Then go. I mean, it is the key principle in medicine is trial and error. Okay. And that if the fancier name for trial and error is called the scientific method. That is a hypothesis followed by an experiment, but it's basically just trial and error. And so that's if you think this morning we had a major reason why the patient failed, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon it's all fixed, then go ahead. Proceed again.
Now let's say the patient passes and we decide we're going to extubate. One question then could be, should we extubate right now? Or should we put the patient back on a more full level of support and do it later? And I would guess you would say there's no reason to do that because there's nothing to rest from if we didn't think this was a fatiguing experience. I mean, there was one trial a handful of years ago that resting them in between may improve their level of success. Would you ever do something like that? And we'll leave out the workflow matter of we're going to extubate, but we're just busy right now, something like that. But
no. I would never dream of doing that. But the workflow matter is big. That is the reason. So I mean, if I'm doing a weaning trial in the middle of rounds and the patient looks good, we don't pull the tube at that time, you know, because we continue seeing the other patients, and then at the end of rounds, say come back, you know, that patient did fine on his T-tube. And so we don't need to repeat anything, stick him back on the ventilator till we're finished seeing the other patients, and then go back. And you don't need to repeat any kind of repeat of anything. Just go and pull the tube at that time.
Okay. And then there's a matter of what do you put them on after extubation? Many kind of routine patients, they'll pop them on a nasal cannula. But I think it's grown in popularity recently to put patients directly to some level of non-invasive support, whether it's high-flow nasal cannula or CPAP or BiPAP, for patients who seem higher risk or are certain populations. And I'm always kind of unsure what to make of this because there seems to be data that supports it and people do better, meaning less likely to be reintubated. But it also seems odd that, you know, spending several hours as this kind of reverse bridge is likely to make a huge difference because, of course, if it's going to be for a long time, then the patient's not ready. I mean, we're not planning to leave them on BiPAP for 2 days after this. That means we sort of failed. And really, when this mostly comes up, is a plan to extubate directly to support, not, of course, to watch them and say, oh, they're having a hard time. We'll put them on something, which everyone would agree with, and is frankly also less work because you don't always need to do so. I mean, sometimes you'll have respiratory therapists or someone say, why are we bothering this? Why don't we just either leave them on if they're not ready or extubate to a cannula if they are? What do you think?
So, I mean, the reason to put somebody on non-invasive following extubation is because you're worried about the patient's work of breathing or the dyspnea, okay? But the problem is people who advocate this, I'm not too sure how many of themselves have actually breathed on CPAP with a non-invasive mask. It's extraordinarily uncomfortable, okay? So, I mean, I've done every kind of manipulation you can do to, you know, breathing through pinholes and what all the rest of it. Breathing on CPAP is mightily uncomfortable. And then the mask around your nose is quite uncomfortable. And so these are patients who are already challenged by dyspnea. And then you add claustrophobia from the mask on top of it. You're really stacking things up to go wrong. So my approach would be, there'll be an occasional patient where I think the patient is ultra fragile and we will go from assist control to a T-piece and then pull the tube and then stick that patient on say, IPAP of 5 or 10, so with non-invasive, plus PEEP of 5. That would be rare. More often it would be that to watch the patient in the first 10 minutes following extubation, see how the patient is doing, and if the patient seems to be doing okay in the first 10 minutes, then leave the patient like that. So that would be with a nasal cannula, a regular nasal cannula. Okay. And so then in occasional patients, then you will say, well, the patient is doing badly, let's stick him on BiPAP. But I mean, I would be, again, looking for a justification, a reason to do it, not preemptively. Preemptively is a problem.
Right, because I think the argument of a lot of people doing it preemptively is to avoid even that perhaps small window where they're in respiratory distress and maybe that, quote, fatigues them. But one of your whole takes today has been that fatigue is not such an issue, so there's little reason to not let the patient show you they need it.
It's not a question that it's not an issue. We spent 10 years searching for it, and after 10 years, we found it didn't occur in one single patient. Okay. So the people who try and tell me about issues, I want to know what data they have and how what they got after 10 years searching for something.
Okay. So it sounds like you would probably be a little more open to extubating somebody to high flow nasal oxygen if, for instance, they seemed ready, they just still needed a rather higher amount of FiO2, let's say. I mean, there's kind of little downside other than the discomfort of some tubing on your face.
Right, but make sure that, again, in these patients, you'd never want a pulse oximeter above 90%, because then you're going to absolutely destroy the power of your pulse oximeter. You're up on the flat portion of the oxygen dissociation curve. You would make sure that your target for your pulse oximeter, it should be 90%, so it's that you're able to see if there's a deterioration. But again, so if you use high-flow nasal cannula, make sure you're setting it so that you're not getting a pulse ox above 90%. It's not the settings on the high flow that's important. It is what's showing up on your pulse ox that's important.
So I just want to make sure people heard that one right. So you don't want to see a pulse oxygenation higher than about 90, because if there is a deterioration in oxygenation, you want to see the abrupt fall off that occurs below that, so it's obvious. Whereas many people would say, I want it to be a more gradual fall off, so it's safer, but you'd like it to be more clear.
Of course, that's the whole, it's monitoring. You want monitoring to pick up stuff that's going wrong. To be operating with a pulse ox of 95%, this is totally putting blinkers on yourself. You're putting on a blindfold. It's completely self-defeating.
Now, I have to ask then, because while this is the less common situation, I'll say less common in the ICU. Many patients like this are in long-term vent weaning facilities and what have you. But patients like this with more chronic respiratory failure, they often do use a process of quote, weaning, where they'll spend, you know, increasing durations of the day on decreasing amounts of support to, quote, strengthen the respiratory muscles and what have you. And it at least seems like it makes more sense in that setting. From the perspective of fatigue and training the diaphragm and so on, do you think that makes sense in that setting?
Right. In that setting, we have a randomized control trial, the only good one, in JAMA, published about 15 years ago by Amal Jabran, looking at in an LTAC, looking specifically at those patients. And again, a trach collar was about twice as effective as pressure support in those patients. So a trach collar is, again, back to making sure that the patient is breathing independently with no ventilator assistance. So again, in those patients, so there, you're approaching it differently, because these are all going to have a tracheostomy. And with a tracheostomy, it's easy. I mean, because you're not going to be dealing with the endotracheal tube and pulling out the tube and all the rest of it. It's simpler in an LTAC patient, but it's the same principles. It's back to understanding the physiology.
My goodness. Okay. Well, a lot of eye-opening stuff today. Brian, what else do you want to talk about?
So what would you think about, you know, the patient who, because I feel like part of the problem with extubating people is finding this balance between the likelihood of success and leaving people in the ventilator longer than necessary. And I find that a lot of times if I put people on even 8/5 and they do well and I extubate them and they do fine, and they get extubated, particularly a lot of times my post-surgical patients, you know, the respiratory therapist will say, well, they failed their SBT this morning. And what they mean is they didn't meet some sort of parameter when they were on 5/5. And, but when you look at them, they're strong, they are pulling good tidal volumes, and you put them on 8/5 and they do well, and you extubate them and they do fine. And so I just wonder, what do you think about striking that balance between being more aggressive, I guess, with extubation, even if it means not, even if it means going easier on them when it comes to the spontaneous breathing trial. Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
I follow, but I mean, the problem is that you think you can figure out based on a tidal volume when you have somebody on a pressure support of 8, and you would be basing it on what is the patient's tidal volume, mm-hmm. on that. That has zero meaning. Zero. Because again, the relationship between that and worker breathing is totally zero. Mm-hmm. So the only thing you want to know before you pull the tube is what is the patient's worker breathing. And if you have somebody in a pressure support of 8, I can assure you it's completely impossible. Because we've done that repeatedly with esophageal balloons. Once you have an esophageal balloon in and you're measuring worker breathing and you have somebody in a pressure support of 8, it is totally impossible for you to guess what is the worker breathing.
I have to ask about the balloons, because many places don't have esophageal manometry, but it sounds like you feel that would be the ideal tool for assessing work of breathing. You said the math is complex, but can you give us just the 30-second soundbite? I mean, are you using numbers like the transpulmonary pressure or something else?
Right. It's the transpulmonary. You stick in the esophageal balloon, and so that it requires a certain technical skill. We've put them in hundreds upon, I would imagine, in our hospital, we've put in more esophageal balloons than anywhere else in the world. And we've published more on esophageal balloons than anywhere else. But it's not the sticking in the balloon that's the problem. It was then when you get the recordings from the balloon, it takes us about 24 hours to do the calculations from those recordings. So you get your transpulmonary pressure. You have to be extraordinarily careful where you do your planimetry on that. And you do a Campbell diagram on it. And it is related to your chest wall regional pressure. It's very complex in terms of the sophistication required for doing the calculations. Sticking in the balloon is the easy part. It's not even the math. It is knowing where to place the lines. And it's just not practical.
Dräger is going to install an AI device that does all the math for you in 10 years. You can quote me on it.
I worked with the forerunners of these people back 20 years ago. So they're, you know, that's fine. So the Bicor system, back in the early 80s, we were doing all this stuff. You know, I mean, it just keeps going around in circles.
What do you want to leave us with as closing thoughts on this topic? And, you know, a fair number of what we talked about is, I think, probably differs somewhat from a lot of people's routine practice. So there may be many things, but, broad strokes, what do you think people are kind of getting wrong when it comes to weaning and breathing trials? And what would you like them to remember?
The key thing is, it's not the SBT. How you do the SBT is not the primary concern. It is when you do the first SBT that is important. And so if you arrive at the bedside and you say, I am confident that this patient will succeed, you got there too late. You should have been there hours, if not days beforehand. And so it is back to cognitive psychology. People have a problem in being suspicious that the patient just might come off the ventilator. And the only way to do that is with weaning parameters. And the F over VT, if done correctly, has a sensitivity of 90%. Very few tests in medicine have sensitivities of 90%. The F over VT is the most studied test in critical care medicine. And so this is what you have to focus on. It is, and it's solely done to alert you to do an SPT. It has no use beyond that.
Well, this has really been something. I hope everyone else has been as interested as we have been. We'll leave it at that and just remind everyone this has only been our own respective opinions. We're not representing our institutions here, and just some general educational discussion, no specific advice for all of you. And we'll talk to you next time.